Secondly, I think it's important to understand that in an otherwise grim world, the continent which is in open rebellion now against neoliberal capitalist politics and against US policies on that continent is Latin America. This is extremely important to grasp because it's not reported regularly, and this too has been misreported. First, in every single Latin American country today, you have a large social movement which is challenging World Bank, IMF, capitalist politics in that region. Whether it's the large social movement in Bolivia fighting against privatization, the Peruvian peasantry which resisted and won a battle against privatizing electricity, whether it's the native populations of Ecuador demanding a say in how the state is governed, whether it's the population of Uruguay defeating a neoliberal president, whether it's the landless peasants in Brazil in their millions refusing to give up on the struggle for land, whether it's the mayor of Mexico fighting against a corrupt regime backed by the United States and looks likely to win the next presidential elections. And of course, at the apex of this movement is the success achieved by the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, where after three attempts, attempts by the United States to overthrow that regime failed. And the last time they tried it, the masses came out into the street in millions to put Chavez back into power, and the soldiers mutinied. They mutinied. And the story of that mutiny is a wonderful story, because it restores all one's faith in the capacity of human beings and political consciousness to change. Because political consciousness is not something which is stable or static or linear. It goes up and down in waves. And what happened in Venezuela when the United States organized coup had taken place, the generals who organized the coup 1 year before they went to war in Iraq, because Venezuela is also an oil-rich country, and they wanted to grab it. Power had been taken away from the oligarchy, and they wanted to give the oligarchs back the power. So it was such a crude maneuver. And Chavez had been elected, not once, but four times in different ways. And when they overthrew him, they found the most corrupt businessman in the country and were swearing him in as president when the mutinies within the army started. And how we found out was that the general organizing the coup brought this, came out of the Miraflores Palace. Chavez was being arrested at a military base, and said to the band which plays the music in the national anthem, he said to them, "The entire Western media is here to see our new president being sworn in, and when I bring him out, you must play the national anthem." And these ordinary soldiers in the band, in their 20s, said, "What new president general? We elected Chavez. Well, where is he?" So the general said, you don't join the army to ask questions. I'm just telling you there is a new president, and when I bring him out, you'll play the national anthem." And the soldiers asked three times the name of the new president. Finally, he gave it, and they started muttering to each other. Then he turned to a 17-year-old bugler who plays the trumpet whenever the president comes out on state occasions, and said to him, "And you, boy, when I bring the new president out, you will play the trumpet to announce him. Can't you see all these television cameras are here?" And this 17-year-old soldier asks the general, "What new president general? Because we elected Hugo Chavez." And the general tells him three times, "You will obey orders or you will be dealt with." And this young soldier takes the bugle and says, "General, you seem really keen that someone plays the bugle. Here, you play it." 17-year-old soldier from a poor peasant family the guts and the consciousness to challenge his general. And what gives him that guts is that for the first time he knows, because he's in touch with his family, that this is a government which is trying to do things for us, for the poor, for our class, for the shanty towns, for the poor peasants without land, for the slum dwellers in Caracas. They're using oil money to build schools, to build homes, to give us deeds to the land which we squat. No other government has ever done that. So the coup failed and Chavez came back in triumph. And then there was, like in Chile against Allende, a middle class strike of doctors and teachers trying to paralyze the system. And they said to each other, we will see how, now that the breweries are closed, how long the shanty towns will love Chavez. And Chavez told me a story the last time I met him. He said even more than the coup, it was the strike of the middle classes that worried me, because I could see our country beginning to disintegrate as we couldn't deliver education or health. And he said, one day I was so depressed, I went into the big shanty towns in Caracas, just with two other people, and started walking around there. And he said, an old woman saw me, and she said, are you Chavez? I said, yeah. She said, come, just come up with me. So she said, she took me by the arm, took me to her slum dwelling, and the family was sitting round a fire in the room, and she was making some soup. And she said, look at my bed, Chavez. I have removed the legs of this bed to use as firewood, because the gas people are on strike, to cook food for my family. And tomorrow I will break the rest of the bed. And the day after, I will burn our table. And the day after that, I will burn the furniture. And then I will go and starve for food, but we don't want you to give up. We don't want you to give up. And he said, as he was walking out, he met a lot of these unemployed youths who came up to him and said, you know, those so-and-sos were saying that we couldn't live without beer. We live without beer. We drink our own piss if necessary. You don't give up. You don't give up. And he said that encounter with the poor in that shanty town gave him more courage than anything else. And then he rang up Fidel and said, we need help. And within 3 weeks, 10,000 Cuban doctors with lots of Cuban medicines arrived in Venezuela, set up clinics in the shanty towns, and transformed the community. Now, what this shows is it can be done if you have politicians with the will to do it. What the reforms that Chavez is pushing through in Venezuela are not all that radical for those of us who grew up in the 60s. But in today's world, they offer a big, big challenge to the world of neoliberalism. And so the whole of Latin America now has become polarized between Chavez and Lula. Lula, who accepts the IMF and what it demands, and Chavez, who does not. And the Venezuelans are saying to other governments in Latin America, let us create a Bolivarian federation in the whole of Latin America. We will help you with the oil. We will give you cheap oil to transform your countries so that we are in a better position to confront the United States. Because unless you have the support of your populations, it is not possible to confront the United States successfully. And he said, in Venezuela, we are ready in waiting, if they ever come. Whether through Colombia or through somewhere else, we are not going to be defeated ever again by them. And I give you these examples to show that sometimes in North America, which is a very large continent, even in Canada, one can get cut off from the rest of the world. But it's a large, large world out there. And a lot of what is happening in different parts, especially in Latin America, are extremely encouraging. So if you look at it from that point of view, in Iraq they had a big series of setbacks. They are not going to be able to pull things together. In Palestine, They taught the Israelis and the United States that the main task of Abu Mazen, who succeeded Arafat, would be to propel him and push him in the direction of launching a Palestinian civil war by saying, you have got to get rid of Hamas, kill them if necessary, before we really do business with you. It's not going to happen, because even Abu Mazen, he wants to please them, but if he does that, he will lose his entire base or a large bulk of it. And to what should he kill Hamas for? What for? So they disengage from Gaza? So what? Gaza will just become a giant labor camp, which would be used for ferrying cheap labor to and from Israel with strict restrictions. That's what it will become. You will not have a Palestinian state. And increasingly now, Palestinians are realizing, if we can't get an independent state, which is a genuine state with contiguous borders, all we get is shriveled little Bantustans. If that's all on offer, let's go for a unified Israel-Palestine with equal rights for Jews and non-Jews in a unified state. But the Zionist establishment will not accept that either. Because the mentality they have is many, many brave Israelis are beginning to point out, but not journalists in North America or even Europe, that Israel is essentially run as an apartheid state. It's run as an apartheid state, and the laws which are imposed on its population, the social laws, are extremely reactionary, which people don't think about. You know, often they're so obsessed with attacking Islam and backward Islam and this, that, and the other, and you have people writing idiotic books called The Trouble with Islam, and all this nonsense goes on in order to try and please the people in power. That's the function of books like that. But recently a group of Israeli filmmakers have made films on the conditions of women in Israel. And there was a showing of them in London recently, and I went with large numbers of people from the Jewish community in London. And it is more difficult for an Israeli woman to get a divorce than it is for most Muslim women in most parts of the Muslim world, with obvious exceptions like Saudi Arabia. It's even easier for an Iranian woman to get a divorce in Iran than it is for an Israeli woman to get a divorce. People are shocked when you say this. The film shows it all. Religious laws are in place. Unless the husband agrees, the woman will not get a divorce. And many, many guys keep their women hanging on. They have the right to have other women, but if the woman does, she's punished. And the judges are completely part of this whole scheme. So that even the picture you get of what happens inside Israel is a very limited picture. And that's not a model we want for a proper state. But those are the two choices. Either a unified state with equal rights and not ruled by the religious laws of any religious group, or an independent Palestine and an Israeli retreat to the 67 frontiers. They are not prepared to accept either of these positions. So they leave the Palestinians with little option but to carry on the struggle, even in these horrible conditions of defeat. And this is the world we live in, and this is a world which is rarely reported, especially in the Western media, where any criticism of Israel is now regarded as anti-Semitic. Why? Because before they went into Jenin, before they went on a spree of killing kids and civilians in the Palestinian villages, the Israeli government had decided, and the Israeli embassies carried this out, to go on a big offensive against anti-Semitism, to put all those who try and defend Palestine on the defensive. Well, some of us will not go on the defensive. And I say, we don't need to be on the defensive. Because the Palestinians have become the indirect victims of the European Judeo side of the Second World War. That's the truth of the matter. That's what's happened. Think about it. Why are the Palestinians to blame? They didn't do anything. What did they do? They were living in their lands and were booted off, ethnically cleansed, killed, villages destroyed. And many Israeli historians now write about this. Benny Morris, great revisionist historian, I don't agree with him, but at least he tells the truth. He says, yeah, we drove them out. We raped their women. I've seen it all in the Israeli archives. Yes, Arab women were raped by Israeli soldiers. It's painful to some people, but it happened. And unless you acknowledge what you did to them, how can you have any reconciliation? And it wasn't their fault. It was so-called European civilization which presided over the massacre of Jews. Christian civilization. That's what did it. Historically, Islamic civilization and Judaic civilization have been close with each other, to each other, till 1948. You go back and look at the history, they often fought together against the Crusaders. They suffered together against the Inquisition and the reconquest of Islamic Spain, Al-Andalus. It's still only in 1948 that this problem began. And it's a tragedy that it's the Palestinians and the Arabs who are blamed for the anti-Semitism which actually led to the destruction of 5-6 million Jews during the Second World War. And many of the governments who are today supporting Israel, the United States and Britain in particular, turned back ships carrying Jewish refugees from Germany. They did that too. So they have their bad consciences. We understand that. But these bad consciences shouldn't make them indifferent to Palestinian suffering today. That too is what is going on. And as long as these conditions exist, the occupation of Iraq, the mess, the tragedy of Palestine, you will not get any lasting peace. That is the history of that region and other regions. And how could you get it? It'd be impossible to demand that. Think if Western countries were in a similar situation. No one would demand it of them. So it can't be demanded of the Iraqis or the Palestinians unless there's a serious attempt to reach a political settlement. And that is something we have to carry on fighting.